The following podcast is part of a certified educational activity titled Prescriptions for Successful Myeloma Care, Pharmacy Strategies for Delivering Effective Therapy with Antibody Platforms. Access the entire activity and complete the post-test at peerview.com/CWA860. Downloadable slides and practice aids are also available.
Good morning, everyone, and welcome to this continuing education program on myeloma, specifically called Prescriptions for Successful Myeloma Care. I'm Donald Harvey. I'm joined by Zahra Mahmoud Jafari and James Davis, and I'm really excited to be here with them today to go through what has been a pretty big landscape shift in myeloma therapy over the years. So we really have molecular biology to thank for a lot of advances in myeloma. And when you think about it, there have been some molecular biology discoveries that have been incredibly helpful and unexpected, and some that have not been as helpful, and some that haven't been helpful at all. And so thinking about CD200 is an example. CD200 and CD138 are all expressed on myeloma cells. However, they're really just used to tag them. They don't have functional things. And so as you remember in pharmacology, you've got binding and activity. And so binding of these agents may or may not have activity over time. And then you move that to the other end of the spectrum, and you think about some of the things that we know are expressed highly on myeloma cells, like B-cell maturation origin or antigen and CD38, ectozymes that then have the ability, when inhibited, to lead to significant downstream events within the cell and within cells surrounding it. Immune activation, direct cell death, et cetera. And you can see this is since 2015, we've had a lot of improvements in the care of myeloma patients due to these molecular biology discoveries. And so overall, you've got daratumumab indications, you've got original indications of that, and isatuximab, elotuzumab, belantamab, mafodotin, the first antibody drug conjugate that was approved. And then finally, you can see a lot's happened recently within BCMA with teclistamab, elranatamab, and then the GPRC5D inhibitor, talquetamab. So all of these agents really have represented fairly recent advances in the care of our patients. CD38 antibodies work through various ways. Certainly binding is a very important way. CD38 is expressed on myeloma cells, also other hematopoietic progenitor cells, as well as eosinophils. And so CD38, you know, targeted antibodies are really targeted. They only hit the thing that they're engineered against. You then have to ask the question, are those targets expressed in normal tissues and therefore lead to potential adverse events that we're trying to mitigate? You can see here the other effects of both of these agents beyond just direct binding. Bispecific antibodies also help because now you've got a linker, an ability to bring two cells together, which is incredibly important. And teclistamab here, you can see again, T cell, CD3 is expressed on every single T cell. And so thinking about ways to sort of spice up the neighborhood, so to speak, and bringing CD3 positive cells to the party with BCMA or GPRC5D with talquetamab. And elranatamab is another agent that also adds to this BCMA bispecific space. And we'll go through each of these agents today. GPRC5D is also very highly expressed on myeloma cells, but also expressed in hair and follicle areas as well as the oral mucosa. And so again, these are on-target agents that really are quite good at inhibiting their target. We just have to think about where that target lives. There's some other emerging bispecifics that are coming forward. Linvoseltamab is another CD3 BCMA combining agent. And then alnuctamab, you can see, has changed a little bit of the engineering. It's two BCMA epitopes with an anti-CD3 epitope and then more of a dead FC area. And so this engineering is ideally thought to, at least preclinically, bind 2-1 and hopefully provide more potency. And linvoseltamab has certainly moved through development quickly, and we've done a lot of work at Emory with that compound as well. When you look worldwide, and this is worldwide, not US-based data, there has been an adoption as of data of 2022, an adoption of antibodies, but worldwide it's really been suboptimal, candidly. We've got a new class of drugs, and you can just make the comparison to, say, rituximab and lymphoma. These really have not been adopted in the same way. A part of it is we have a plethora of new advances and how to sequence those and how practitioners choose that can be challenging in different areas. However, I would argue that You, depending on where you sit in the world, antibody therapy at least needs to be incorporated more often in second line treatment. We know that it's an advantage, and many of us would argue that in the front line setting, we also have that opportunity. Real world outcomes show an ongoing need to think about these patients. First of all, myeloma is becoming a little bit like some solid tumors you might think of, breast cancer, et cetera. We have lots and lots of therapies now and lots of advances that have created a very good problem, and that's what to do with the individuals in an incurable disease that still have disease burden despite a very prolonged progression-free survival time. So then how do we look at that? And you can see this is data suggesting that even after they are penta-exposed or refractory to various agents, that there are still opportunities for treatment and opportunities to improve lives beyond this. It's certainly quality of life becomes incredibly important here. However, we also need to think that we've got opportunities for patients who have good performance status and still need therapies. What can we do as pharmacists? I would say everything personally, but certainly we oversee and have overlap with a lot of different areas within patient care and within the clinics, working with our physician colleagues, our advanced practice colleagues, and a variety of nursing staff, et cetera, to really make sure that patients with this disease are cared for completely and that every nook and cranny is filled, all the boxes are checked for ensuring patients are minimized adverse events, well-educated, interactions are prevented, and dosing is appropriate. Pathology is growing in the way we look at things, and certainly not really within myeloma outside of staining, but and occasionally genetic abnormalities, but generally your pathology group has been a growing area of interest for pharmacists across the board, and myeloma isn't an exception. So what are we going to do today? We're going to hopefully give you some ideas around the evidence that's out there and interpret that evidence. We're going to help to hopefully give you skills for how to manage integration of these agents into the care of individuals with myeloma. And then finally, give you some strategies that can be used for some of the practical aspects in thinking about how to manage some of the adverse events, how to think about dosing and days of the week types of things, adverse event management, and hopefully some more advanced supportive therapy ideas. So with that, I'll turn the podium over to Zara, and we thank you for your attention.
Hey, good morning, everyone. I'm glad to be here with you. It sounds like I have an extra clicker. Okay. It sounds like there's some snow up in Wisconsin. So for those of you up in that part of the country, welcome to some warmer weather. Happy to be here on an early morning and have a lot to discuss. Now, certainly my portion of our presentation is focusing on the CD38 antibody platforms, but just like Dawn just went over really quickly, there's been a lot of changes in multiple myeloma over the last, I don't know, 5, 6, 7 years, but certainly a lot of updates and changes with the CD38 antibody platforms as well. So I'm going to keep this as more of a discussion, and I think it's really nice to be able to go through a case when you're trying to apply some of this more clinical information. So I did warn both Don and James that I was going to change the discussion over to them. So, you know, nothing like putting them on the spot first thing in the morning. So our first patient is a 68-year-old male who presented with multiple myeloma with a performance status of 1, who has no other medical history, which is pretty good for 68, standard risk cytogenetics, who is deemed to be transplant eligible. And so really, at this point, we're deciding what between a CD38 quad versus a triplet regimen. So I would ask you, James, is a quadruplet a reasonable option for us to consider in this patient?
Yeah, definitely. I think that you've got a new patient, new diagnosis, so the first remission that we get in myeloma is the most important, as every subsequent relapse will be shorter and shorter progression-free survival. So I think, I tell my learners, my residents and my students that you don't save Patrick Mahomes, you know, for the last quarter of the game, you put him in first, so you want your best drugs up front to get the deepest remission possible to help that last longer. So I think quads, we have data that you'll go through. I think quads are the way to go up front for this patient.
I appreciate the Patrick Mahomes reference being from Kansas City. Appreciate that. And then what is the role of the pharmacist in counseling this patient on efficacy and safety expectations between quadruplet and triplet? And I think you really summed that up really nicely in the fact that we want to be as aggressive as possible in these patients. And, you know, our counseling points in terms of safety expectations are about the same regardless. Of course, with the quads, we have some other important points to consider that we'll get into in a few slides. So for the purpose of time, we're going to keep going. So kind of changing this a little bit, if there were high-risk features, how would that change your treatment options? Would we be more inclined then to utilize quads? What do you think, James?
Yeah, I think that, you know, these high-risk patients, whether they're high-risk cytogenetics or they have stage 3 RISS or extramedullary disease, they're really tough to treat regardless. So I think, again, using the best therapy that you have up front, you know, you don't save Tom Brady, you don't save Patty to the end, put them in front is the best strategy.
Awesome. And then, Don, on these two, lessons learned from our previous experience, granted, of course, with the CD38s, we obviously had them in the relapse refractory space. Now we're seeing them in the more newly diagnosed setting. Are there any nuances for dosing and administration here? And then anything we've learned from that vast experience we've had?
Yeah, I mean, I think when you look at this patient, there are a few things to consider. One is we know that there are adverse events, that there are first dose adverse events, and that's been revolutionized by subcutaneous therapy. With daratumumab specifically, but really, you know, don't underestimate supportive care in the care of cancer, because so many things that that patients will complain about and potentially stop therapy due to are those initial experiences they have with adverse events from care. And so certainly subcutaneous therapy can be incredibly helpful to get depth of response within these patients. And then, you know, their PS1 is likely due to the disease. And so more aggressive therapy, I think, is not to be underappreciated either. We think about renal insufficiency in other areas that are myeloma caused. Many times people want to get fairly conservative, but we really, in those instances, I think need to be more aggressive, because we can turn those patients around and then manage things later.
Absolutely. I couldn't have said it better myself. Thank you. Okay, so let's change this up a little bit. Still have a patient named Robert, but now he's somewhat older, 76 years old, with a performance status of 2, who now has hypertension and COPD and now is deemed to be transplant ineligible. So here, how would you adapt your counseling? And I'd say either one of you can answer this one. Would you adapt your counseling in any way regarding a CD38 platform in a patient who is transplant ineligible?
Well, since I'm the oldest one on the panel and closer to 68 and 76 than you both are, certainly, you know, first do no harm comes into play a bit. The question is, what is the most pressing issue in this individual? Is it his myeloma, or is it one of the comorbid illnesses that might lead to further complications downstream? And so sort of taking an approach of go slow and low might be much more helpful here. And thinking about quad versus triplet, you might dose abrogate some of these things initially and then step up as they tolerate, or you might pick a triplet and add a 38 antibody later on, or truly save Patrick Mahomes for the third quarter, maybe not the fourth quarter.
Patrick has no idea he's a topic of conversation in Tampa at 7 a.m. Great. Thank you guys so much in helping lead us through the original case questions, or rather discussion points. And then we're going to go through a little bit more of the didactics and more, be a little bit more of the background. And, you know, I think with anyone who is perhaps a new learner pulls up the NCCN guidelines, can quickly close the NCCN guidelines when they look at this, because it all just looks like the same thing over and over again. And really what it boils down to is individualized treatment for our patients. And so when you look at the NCCN guidelines, this has stayed pretty consistent over a long time. You have primary therapy for patients who are deemed transplant eligible, and then you have primary therapy for patients that are deemed non-transplant eligible, or patients who may have more comorbidities or more frail, et cetera. And we're seeing a lot of various changes in the NCCN guidelines with our preferred category 1 recommendations of bortezomib, lenalidomide, and dexamethasone, and then other recommended regimens, including daratumumab and the CD38s in a quad kind of fashion. So lots going on here, but it all really boils down to the comorbidities, performance status, and really other patient-specific factors when we're deciding what our treatment options will be for newly diagnosed multiple myeloma. I personally don't find the NCCN guidelines particularly helpful in this space, just because it is so individualized, but it is nice to see that we have so many options. And I think most importantly, there was a lot of data at ASH that was presented, but this one was a particular study that caught a lot of attention, one that we were waiting for. You know, when we discussed triplets versus quads, we had the Griffin study that really kind of originally started this conversation, which was a phase 2 study in about 200 patients. And then this one really just took it up a notch. So we have the Perseus study, which was a phase 3 randomized trial in over 700 patients that were eligible and newly diagnosed with a performance status less than 2. The primary endpoint in this study was progression-free survival with a median follow-up of 47 and a half months. And we had about the same matched number of patients between the DARA VRD arm versus the VRD arm alone. And what we found in this trial, which was very impressive, was a 48-month progression-free survival of 84.3% as opposed to 67%. So further really solidifying the role of quad therapy in newly diagnosed multiple myeloma and transplant-eligible patients, and also saw a sustained MRD negativity as well. And so we were able to have 64% of patients were able to discontinue the DARA maintenance after achieving MRD negativity. So at least for me and for many of us that have discussed this study, this really has solidified the role of quads in newly diagnosed multiple myeloma. Certainly trying to operationalize this, we can get into the discussions of the consolidation and maintenance and the dosing, et cetera. But I would definitely say that there is a role for quads in newly diagnosed multiple myeloma. Kind of not to be outdone, we also are seeing daratumumab triplets and quads continue to show benefits in our transplant ineligible patients. So we have the MAIA study, which established DARA and RD triplet as upfront therapy in newly diagnosed ineligible patients. Again, in a median follow-up of 64 and a half months, a prolonged progression-free survival that continued to improve in that triplet therapy. And then Alcyone, which is primarily done in Europe and maybe not as done as frequently here in the United States, a quadruplet with DARA and VMP in transplant-ineligible patients, again, showing a very robust progression-free survival response. So again, we're seeing lots of benefits even in patients who are considered transplant-ineligible. And to Don's earlier point, we have seen a great change between IV dosing and sub-Q dosing, which really has been a kind of a treatment-changing paradigm, at least in my organization. I think most centers are utilizing more of the sub-Q dosing, which is that flat dose dosing over 3 to 5 minutes, has significantly changed our chair time. Of course, we're trying to turn out patients as quickly as we can because chair time is at a premium. So certainly, there are some potential centers that are continuing to use IV, but I think most of us have transitioned over to sub-Q. So some of the more recent safety insights from Perseus include that, not surprisingly, we continue to see the neutropenia and thrombocytopenia adverse events in these patients, but the safety profile of daratumumab combined with VRD, very consistent with our known safety profiles for each individual agent. So information there. But not to be outdone, we do have another CD38 antibody option. And so the current experience with isatuximab in transplant-eligible patients include ISCHIA, which is a phase 3 trial assessing isa-KRD as pre-transplant induction and post-transplant consolidation versus KRD, again, seeing significantly increased post-consolidation MRD negativity. Definitely seeing lots more MRD data here in the multiple myeloma space, and we don't have a lot of time to talk about what those implications look like. And then additionally in Skylark with a phase 2 trial assessing once weekly KRD and isatuximab in newly diagnosed transplant eligible patients, again, demonstrating deep and durable responses in these patients that are eligible for transplant. Again, same kind of safety toxicity profiles are similar with other previous reports, and we can certainly administer this in a community-based setting. So what about using isatuximab as a new quad option in newly diagnosed multiple myeloma? And this was had its original kind of readout. It's met its primary endpoint, and so we're looking forward to the results of the IMROZ trial. So again, showing progression-free survival and a benefit in newly diagnosed multiple myeloma patients not eligible for transplant. So really just taking home the point of the CD38s in our newly diagnosed multiple myeloma patients. And just kind of showing the quadruplet dosing used in the IMROZ trial specifically. You've got your isatuximab on day 1, 8, 15, and 22, and then your bortezomib, give or take 1, 4, 8, and 11, et cetera. And then you've got your continuous phase thereafter. So pretty similar to what other studies have been designed. And then there is an emerging sub-Q formulation of isatuximab. I know one particular barrier, at least at my organization, of using isatuximab is that it continues to be IV. That with this particular formulation that's being studied, that could, kind of be a competitor against our currently available subcutaneous options. And so this was a non-inferiority trial, but it's being assessed in a phase 3 study, which is 10 milligram per kilo every 4 weeks. And then the sub-Q will be an on-body delivery that shows comparable efficacy and a hands-free option. So we'll see if this will be approved anytime soon, but potential option in our patients to reserve our chair time. So some of the important factors in terms of being a pharmacist and counseling our patients, you know, I think, how do we counsel patients about high-risk features of multiple myeloma and the role of CD38 antibodies? You know, we need to understand these high-risk cytogenetics. There's a difference between one cytogenetic abnormality and more than one cytogenetic abnormality and how aggressive we'd like to be in treatment. So, you know, those ultra-high-risk patients, we would like to be as aggressive as we physically can. And so in the Perseus study, adding Dara to VRD improved progression-free survival versus VRD alone, despite patients having high-risk cytogenetics. Again, we're seeing that median follow-up of 47.5 months not reached and versus 44.1 months in the VRD arm. So keeping in mind that there still is a role for CD38 antibodies in the setting of high-risk disease. And then so how about looking at patients and their role when they are in more of a relapse multiple myeloma setting, again, seeing that the CD38 platforms have shown efficacy in these high-risk settings as well. So lots to be said even for those patients with relapse multiple myeloma who have acquired a new genetic mutation or amplification, or the AGEL where we all talk about extramedullary disease at relapse, still seeing efficacy with the CD38 platforms. You know, when the CD38s were first approved, there was lots of discussions about hypersensitivity reactions, of course, a prolonged chair time. And so we have a lot of required pre-medications. And then, you know, adding Montelukast about 30 minutes prior to the first daratumumab infusion has shown to lower the infusion reaction rates. And I know that at least at our center, we have it pre-built in our treatment plans. And so you want to make sure that all of our patients have those required pre-meds to try to minimize the risk for hypersensitivity. And finally, on my last slide, just some, you know, general take-home points. And, you know, CD38s are pretty well tolerated, but we do have some important points to consider in making sure that, you know, we've properly prophylaxed our patients. That is one, beyond just the pre-medications, want to make sure that you provide them what I call the trifecta. So, you know, bacterial, fungal, and viral prophylaxis in those patients that are neutropenic, but of course, at a minimum, the HSV prophylaxis. Patients with multiple myeloma are no strangers to immunoglobulin replacement, and then making sure that we are doing our pre-therapy blood screening. And then our observation period, you know, has evolved. At least at my center, we've now changed our sub-Q observation period from several hours to 30 minutes with the first dose and then 10 minutes thereafter. So we've really cut down on our infusion time. This was a big lift in our clinics prior to the sub-Q formulation and then more experience. So just a few take-home points. And with that, I'm going to transition to James to talk through some of our antibody options.
Thank you. I promise I won't talk about football anymore. I did that just for Zara. We're going to transition now from talking about CD38 and quads and incorporation of the CD38 platforms to some a little bit newer therapies, the bispecific antibodies. So getting started, we'll start with a patient case. We have Margaret, who's 79 years old. She has had four lines of therapy, including transplant, autologous stem cell transplant, maintenance, several other relapses after that. I will point out that she has high-risk disease, so you can see her remissions, they're not very long, 11 months, 6 months, 2 months. At this point, we haven't planned CAR T for this patient. So that being said, how do you, Zara, Don, decide between, you know, CAR T or bispecific? She's failed 4 lines. She's eligible for both options. How do you, you know, talk to these patients or decide between the two?
If I may, you know, as a true pharmacist, I'm going to ask a few additional questions, but I think you can't just, you know, upfront say I will choose CAR T versus bispecifics with just the information presented on the slide. You know, there's some additional considerations in terms of other comorbidities. High risk cytogenetics are one consideration. Do you have access to CAR T cells in your center? What else is going on with this patient's disease status? Do they have perhaps the luxury of time in order to, you know, collect and then have the CAR T cells versus, you know, the bispecifics have that off-the-shelf availability? Could be something to consider. I would say this one's a little more challenging to answer, only in the case of I need additional information before I can commit to an option. Yeah.
Don, any thoughts?
Yeah, I mean, her most recent treatment line lasted 2 months, and, you know, one might argue a little bit around the value of that. And so, therefore, to me, in terms of thinking about progressive disease, you probably don't have a lot of time. That's a fairly short window for an IgG spike. And so thinking about something that's going to be more readily available might be preferable.
Yeah. And then further in that point, how can pharmacists, most of us here, be prepared and talk to patients about these options, including step-up dosing, hospital protocols, and so forth? So we'll cover that on subsequent slides. Same case here. What is the role in the pharmacist in managing preventing infections? We're going to cover that in a slide. I don't want to ruin it. But besides that, are there any other adverse event management principles that you guys think should be included when we talk to this patient or we plan her therapy besides infections? Any comments on maybe step-up dosing per se?
Yeah, certainly. I think we're learning quite a bit about step-up dosing, inpatient versus outpatient. There's a lot to have been learned here. I think there's a good opportunity for our pharmacists to provide great education related to that. We all have kind of taken our own interpretation of the step-up dosing and made some adjustments based on our operational needs, of course, with the opportunity for patients and her in particular probably being a little less aggressive, if you will, just to make sure she can tolerate it.
I think nothing to add to that. That's great.
I think a lot of questions, you know, we all work at large referral centers. We get a lot of patients referred in from more rural practices. These local docs want to know, hey, can I do these bispecifics in my local practice? And if so, do I really have to admit them to the hospital? Do you have to have tocilizumab? What do we do for CRS? You know, how do you grade CRS? They don't have CAR T at their centers. They're not familiar with CRS and neurotoxicity. So those are some things. Those are a lot of the questions that we get. Any thoughts with how that might pan out, or what you do at your centers for education or referrals for those patients?
The big thing here to remind ourselves when it comes to a community setting is that different than the CAR T cells, we do have the opportunity to use the prophylactic dexamethasone to prevent any really significant cytokine release syndrome. And so utilizing dexamethasone pre-medications, really having a robust conversation with our community-based settings, sharing our protocols and algorithms, maybe helping stems, maybe some of the concerns, the anxieties related to CRS. We've done at least the CAR T centers, myself included, have done a pretty good job of scaring our community-based colleagues. But it is completely manageable. And of course, we have the benefit of utilizing steroids ahead of time. So,
yeah, I think that, the community is where, 8 out of 10 patients are treated. So we need to make sure that we're communicating well in patients that are traveling back and forth between various settings and making sure that everyone's aligned in terms of what needs to happen with various adverse events.
All right, thanks. So with that, we're going to get through some slides, and I think we have another question or so at the end. So we have patients now, they have relapsed after 4 prior lines of therapy. NCNC and guidelines is what you're looking at. We actually have the option between 2 commercially approved CAR T-cell therapies and 3 bispecific antibodies. Today, we don't have time to talk about the CAR T cell therapies. That's a whole nother hour's discussion. So we're going to focus on the bispecific antibodies. 2 of these antibodies, elranatamab and teclistamab, target BCMA, which is a protein that Don talked about earlier. And then talquetamab is more of a novel. It's the newest of the 3. It targets GRPC5D. It targets another protein that's on the myeloma cells and then also on keratinized tissue and oral. So we'll talk about those in detail. So we'll talk about teclistamab first. So teclistamab was approved based off the MajesTEC-1 trial. And then we have some updated follow-up data from ASCO and then some real-world data from a number of abstracts at ASH this year. The ASCO data was a 22-month follow-up that showed patients without receiving prior BCMA had a 63% overall response rate. And then that's broken down on the graph on the right. You can see that the majority of those responses were fairly deep, CR greater in almost 46% of the patients. And that's really good, especially since we've seen with the prior approval agents before CAR T and bispecific, those overall response rates were in the 20% at best. So tripling that number is really fortunate for the patients these days. There was some real-world data at ASH. This second reference here, actually Zara and I were co-authors on this one. There's a number of other abstracts at ASH, and we found in our prior BCMA-exposed patients that there were similar overall response rates. Those patients, despite prior exposure or refractoriness to a BCMA agent, which most of them had prior CAR T, but some bispecifics, those patients responded pretty well too. We saw in the ASCO data that responses deepened over time with median progression-free survival of about 12 and a half months for teclistamab. Teclistamab, we talked a little bit about step-up dosing. These agents are given via what we call step-up dosing. So when I talk to my patients, I say, the first dose we give you is a little baby dose, the second dose is a medium dose, and the third dose is the real thing. And with each dose, we're going to monitor you for these common side effects, CRS or cytokine release syndrome, which is typically a fever. In the Majestic 1 study, almost all of the patients had grade 1 or 2 CRS, which is a fever and maybe a little bit of trouble breathing. You might need a little bit of oxygen. There was maybe one instance of grade 3 CRS. So very manageable, like you said, in an outpatient setting with typically steroids. Not really a need for TOCI in my mind, although some centers do use it. And then more recently, there was the FDA approved biweekly dosing for teclistamab. So patients that that have a complete remission after a minimum of 6 months, those patients can transition from once a weekly dosing to biweekly dosing. And that's really great for patients. They don't have to come in, you know, only half as often. So save some trips to the infusion center. Safety events with teclistamab, and this is kind of consistent through all the BCMA bispecifics due to the targeting BCMA on the myeloma cells. We see a lot of infections after the step-up dosing is done where you see CRS and maybe a little bit of neurotoxicity. Infections are our biggest issue here. This teclistamab data, the Majestic 1 study, was conducted during the height of COVID. So COVID, the 27% COVID number may be a little bit more than we see nowadays, but infections are really a thing. And so we're going to talk about how to prevent those in a little bit. So what about elranatamab? It's the other BCMA targeting bispecific. It was approved based on the MagnetisMM-3 study. And there were some updates at ASH. For extended data, so at 15.9-month follow-up, they found that patients that hadn't received prior BCMA, overall response rate was 61%. Patients, there was a cohort that received prior BCMA. The overall response rates were a little bit lower there, but still pretty good compared to historical standards. The median progression-free survival, 17.2 months, and overall survival, almost 22 months for those patients. You can see the depth of responses broken down on the chart on the right. Again, 35% of complete response or stringent complete responses, those are really good numbers when we're talking about this late therapy late in the game. Again, elranatamab, step-up dosing here, baby dose, middle dose, full dose, days 1, 4, and 8. So a little bit different than teclistamab, but there is some margin there. A lot of centers don't actually do the 1, 4, 8. They might do 1, 3, 5, or, you know, space these these bispecifics out a little bit, depending on the patient and such. This one is also approved for biweekly dosing later in the line if patients have adequate response. So you start the step-ups, you get weekly, and then you transition to biweekly later on. Again, infections big here. This was also conducted in the COVID era, so a lot of COVID infections, and not surprisingly, CRS during the step-up schedule. After the step-up dosing is complete, these patients in any of the bispecifics, you don't really see CRS or neurotoxicity. So it's really just infections after that. So key points for pharmacists and any practitioners when we're talking about these BCMA bispecifics, we really need to talk to the patients about, you know, you talk to them about step-up dosing, you probably are going to get hospitalized or at least put in an observation unit after each dose. There's not really much they can do to prevent that other than prophylactic steroids and the step-up dosing in itself, and typically acetaminophen and an H1 blocker to prevent that. But infections is really the take-home point here. So we want to talk to patients, you know, if you go home and you've been on this therapy and you have a fever, we want to be called. If you have a cough that doesn't clear up after a week, we want to know. We put at my institution, because of the PJP numbers, we use prophylaxis, PJP prophylaxis with either of these two options. We use HSV, typically acyclovir at my institution for all these patients. And then IVIG is a little bit tougher because a lot of the insurances don't want to pay for it because a lot of these patients have IgG myeloma. They might have high IgG. The insurance says, oh, it's not less than 400. We don't want to pay for it. But I don't think they realize that because these immunoglobulins are non-functional because they're myeloma, that they're not going to help prevent infection. So we at my institution give everyone that we can get it approved for IVIG supplementation to prevent infections. This is a really good multi-center review article on infection management specific to bispecifics. That was put together by Dr. Moen. I think she's at Wisconsin, and Dr. Costa in Alabama, some of the leaders in the myeloma field. So back to our patient, same patient, 79, high-risk myeloma. This time she got CAR-T planned. She's been referred to CAR-T and had CAR-T cell therapy, but unfortunately she's now progressed after a year. So you guys, how do you think you would counsel this patient on next steps? Do you have a go-to, would you pick BCMA or GPRC5D? And if you did pick talquetamab, which we'll talk about in a second, what do you think we should counsel them regarding adverse effects and dosing?
Yeah, so thinking about next steps, I mean, you know, either BCMA or GPRC5D could be considered. I think the weight of the evidence is with BCMA bispecifics and thinking about what's there. I think one of the things that's been impressive to me with both these classes of compounds is durability of response. And certainly those would both be possible for her at this point. And if it was tau, again, the dosing is step up. It's adverse events of taste considerations, which can be problematic to patients, as well as skin and nail changes. And then, of course, the persistent hypogammaglobulinemias and cytopenias that are there. So it's really, you know, she's now 79. She's seen some therapies, including CAR-T. What's her performance status? Is she frail, et cetera? And how do you go about thinking about that? And a lot of it is, what do you have the most comfort with, as well as a center? You can have institutional memory and experience. But Zara?
Yeah, no, I completely agree. I mean, we have seen activity. I mean, in general, when you're talking through various options, you tend not to pick a product that has the same mechanism of action or target. But we have seen decent activity in patients who previously received BCMA CAR in receiving a BCMA bispecific. But I agree with a lot of the considerations. Often, I want additional more detail on case, but I would maybe try to err on the GPRC5D as a potential option, or depending on what her other characteristics are, maybe try to reserve that, because it does have its specific nuances in terms of adverse events, and those are not a walk in the park. So, and we're learning more about them with additional experience, but we still have an opportunity and a long way to go.
Yeah, so let's talk about talquetamab. So talquetamab is a GPRC5D, I got it right, sorry, bispecific antibody that was approved based on the Monumental 1 study. It showed deep and durable responses with overall response rates in the 70% and 288 patients who were naive to T-cell therapy. You can see there was a cohort that had T-cell prior T-cell directing therapy, and those overall responses are broken down on the graph on the right. Prior BCMA CAR-T had a little bit higher responses than patients that had prior BCMA targeted bispecifics, but still very impressive responses, again, this late in the game. Talquetamab is approved two different dosing schedules. We have step-up dosing, but it's approved weekly from the start, or you can actually pick a biweekly option, which most patients in my institution prefer, and the overall response rates were very, very similar between the two. So biweekly from the start is a little bit different than the other antibodies that you wait, you know, 6 months to start biweekly here. Safety, you know, you have the same infections, maybe a little bit less than the BCMA targeting, CRS and neurotoxicity, maybe a little bit during low grade and the step up dosing. But then we have some unique talquetamab side effects due to the target and the off-site target of the keratinized tissue in the oral mucosa. So we see a fair amount of rashes on patients, kind of looking like sunburn. Those are pretty well managed with topical, sometimes steroids or ammonium lactate kind of creams. We see some nail-related events, dry, crusty, just kind of gross nails, mostly cosmetic, not typically fungal infections in my experience. And probably the most difficult to manage is the taste changes and the weight loss that some patients experience. Those can be difficult. We don't really have great strategies other than telling patients, hey, try to find some kind of food that you like that, you know, doesn't taste terrible. And your job is to, you know, eat, not lose weight. And that's your homework, essentially, is to find something that you like. And it's probably not the same thing that you liked before you started. But I've seen that the taste changes actually improve in some patients the further they get on therapy. So take homes for bispecifics. We have a couple of different targets, off-the-shelf options. They don't have to have their cells pheresed and manufactured like CAR T-cell therapy. So they're, you know, right there. If you have a patient, you can admit them right away and you don't have to wait five or six weeks for cells to come back to treat them. Three options commercially available right now. Infections continue to be probably the most problematic options, at least for the BCMA antibodies. CRS, I think most centers that have CAR T are pretty well versed in managing that. And then what is the role of the pharmacist? We're all pharmacists. I would assume most of us are pharmacists here. So how do we help in patients that are receiving bispecifics? And we can do everything, essentially. I do a lot of patient counseling. I create the protocols and the treatment plans we're on Epic. I do all those and make sure the supportive care, the IVIG plans, all that stuff is entered. The patients are taking their supportive care meds. I sit on the P&T committee. So when these agents come before the committee, you can explain to the physicians that may not practice malignant hematology why it's important to have these agents available to treat our patients. And I said patient counseling. So a lot of different hats pharmacists can wear. Don?
All right. We're running a little short on time. We want to make sure we have plenty of time for Q&A. So I'm going to be fairly quick here in newer antibody platforms. So this is our back to our patient again, our 79-year-old. What are some future off-the-shelf antibody options that can be considered here? And I'm going to tell you those. So some of the areas that are here and mechanisms in development, linvoseltamab is a compound that's moving quickly through approval. It's another BCMA CD3 bispecific antibody. We've used it at our center a fair bit in trials, and so it's been an interesting compound to think about. The AbbVie compound is another one, IgG4 backbone, which may make some difference compared to IgG1. Alnuctamab, I mentioned earlier, has two BCMA epitopes along with the CD3 antibody. And then finally, sovostamab is the Fc receptor antagonist with CD3, another immunotherapeutic approach, the receptor homolog 5. So linvoseltamab is listed here, linker myeloma 1. Again, efficacy is quite good with 200 milligrams as a flat dose given intravenously, or response rate around 70%, with many of those obtaining a VGPR higher. Again, median PFS hasn't been reached. So a lot of these compounds, these BCMA and the GPRC5Ds, have these fairly prolonged responses, which again is interesting and something that makes us think scientifically about the T-cell milieu, the B-cell milieu, and what is that looking like in individuals who have and potentially don't have these longer-term responses. So this is the step-up dosing. Again, in the interest of time, I'm going to go fairly quickly, but 24-hour hospitalization early and then moving on into standard dosing weekly and then every 2 weeks based on tolerability and depth of response. Safety, again, CRS is present as a class effect of these drugs. Triple refractory diseases here, and so the priming dose is where you see the most action, and it happens then, but then subsequently other things tend to recur, tend to reduce in frequency and severity. Infections and ICANS are both listed here. Again, early adverse events are common, but subsequent doses tend to be less problematic. Alnuctamab subcutaneously, 78-patient experience here with target dose optimization above 30 or higher. And again, target dose moving up over time. Follow-up's been about a year. And again, the activity has been seen at doses of 30 milligrams and higher. So similarly for alnuctamab, moving forward, the screening is here. And then days 1, 4, 8, 15, and 11 on that schedule weekly, every 2 weeks, and then every 4 weeks. And each of these antibodies, as you think about the clearance mechanisms, they are depleting the cell that clears them. And so you start to get longer, you start to see reduced clearance and longer half-lives of compounds over time because the cell itself, the BCMA-positive cell, the CD38-positive cell, are getting eliminated, and therefore your clearance mechanism is reducing. So what can we think about with new agents in this space and newer therapies that are possible? Again, there are similarities and differences in targets, and what does that lend to clinically? What does it lend to potentially for other practical operational reasons as well in terms of delivering these treatments to patients? That's all to be potentially defined. Linvoseltamab, alnuctamab are moving forward. Again, location sequencing is certainly continuing to be an issue. Patient-specific sequencing has really driven the conversation of the day for patients based on their backgrounds, because many of these agents are approved in the exact same spaces. And then again, counseling is critical for us, our nursing colleagues, our advanced practice colleagues, to make sure that individuals understand what they need to do and have good follow-up when they need it. All right, let's head to the Q&A. I'm going to return down here and ask Zorara to sort of lead us through what we've got and what's interesting in the Q&A section.
Yeah, so thank you so much. There are a lot of really great questions that have been submitted. I'm not certain if you all can see it from your end. I'm guessing not. So I'm going to read a few of the questions. We have approximately 8 minutes. I am an achiever, so we're going to get through a lot of them. All right, so first is really quick. Have you considered implementing prophylactic tocilizumab prior to bispecific antibody therapy? And if so, how are you using it at your centers?
Yeah, that's a really great question. And that's not the first time I've heard that one. I know that Don Center has some data that came out at ASH and then was published in Blood Cancer Journal. And then I think Mayo has some data that they both did prophylactic toci. And it works. It prevents high-grade CRS and may allow for quicker step-up dosing potentially. At my center, we don't do it because we have really good outcomes using the standard DEX, acetaminophen H1 antagonist. And then if they have CRS, we typically go to DEX before we go to TOCI. And we have been successful in managing CRS without giving that. But I know that is an attractive option, especially if you're able to get it paid for and you want to do outpatient ramp up or step up dosing. But it's currently not approved for bispecific CRS, only for CAR T, so that could be a challenge. Don, do you have any thoughts?
Yeah, no, we're trying to push the envelope at Emory, and if these agents were much less expensive, this wouldn't even be a question, right? So we've adopted Montelukast for everybody with CD38. If this was Montelukast, we would be using it for prophylaxis. Again, supportive care matters. We believe in that at our center, and so we're pushing insurance companies to say, hey, in the end, this you're paying now, but ideally you won't see this problem later on to the same degree. And to your point, James, trying to really get patients to the outpatient setting is what we're trying to do as well, to give them more freedom. And bed crunches are real everywhere.
Great. Thank you guys both. I agree, obviously. We're kind of in the middle of mm-hmm. both. And we also don't use prophylactic tocilizumab up front, but I can see where, again, if cost didn't matter, it would be a potential option. We did not have time to talk through the REMS, but there is a question about which I love talking about, as most people know. How does your center manage the REMS certification if a patient would be returning to their referring physician?
That's a good question.
Okay, I can answer this.
I am trying, then you correct me. How about that?
Okay.
So each treating center has to be REMS certified. At least for the Janssen products. And they have the Tecvayli or the teclistamab and the talquetamab have a joint REMS program. So if you're registered for one, it's pretty easy to get certified for the other product. But if they're going back to the referring physician, the referring physician does have to be REMS enrolled and registered that way in order to get the doses from their distributor. Yeah.
Yeah.
Correct me if I'm wrong.
Nope, you're absolutely right. That you have to make sure that you're correct. The provider at that organization has to be REMS certified, as does the center in which the patient is receiving the medication needs to be certified under their own dispense off. So correct. Not that I was testing you. The next one is, what do your centers do for patients that are neutropenic with teclistamab and or elranatamab? Hold G-CSF, go to biweekly before 6 month CR?
I'll go. I looked at Don. He didn't look back, so.
Fascinated with the rapidity of the questions coming in.
Yeah, yeah. So we do weekly filgrastim while they're on tech. We would not go to biweekly sooner if I don't think that's in the best interest of the patient. If they're, you know, high grade neutropenia, we might hold a dose for a week or two and wait till that rebounds a little bit. We typically do once or twice weekly filgrastim for those patients. There is some data that, you know, if they're in the step up dosing phase, they have a higher, theoretically there's a higher rate of CRS if they're if you give them growth factors. But I think there is if they're inpatient in the step up dosing, that's probably okay because they're being monitored. So I think GCSF is the answer there, most likely.
You're right. There are a lot of questions related to neurotoxicity as it relates to bispecifics. So maybe I'll try to combine questions 3 and 5. Any advice on standardizing CRS ICANS management? And have you found patients receiving bispecifics after CAR T tend to be more prone to CRS or neurotoxicity?
I mean, the CAR T seems a bit more fulminant in terms of what's there. You've got a lot more action at the immune cell level. And so you're really, you know, similarly, again, prophylaxis is helpful, thinking about it carefully. I think optimally we want to try to minimize neurotoxicity however we can. And so thinking about the two areas, you know, good monitoring is critical, but as much as we can load up front and get away with, quote unquote, I think we're trying to do, because it's going to be scary for patients. And even with counseling, it can be something that is problematic for them. And when you mess with the head, it's bad stuff. So we try to minimize that whenever we can.
I would say for us, we have standardized treatment algorithms related to CRS and ICANS management. And our algorithm does have specifics related to each bispecific, just because there are some unique nuances. But I think that you could make the argument that a standardized treatment protocol is fine. It's pretty much the same. There's just some specific little nuances between them. But I haven't necessarily seen an increased risk of CRS in those patients who've previously had CAR T. It's kind of an independent adverse event. Okay.
Typically, the CRS, the severity is most likely related to the disease burden at the time of initiation. So just because they had a higher disease burden and had CRS or ICANS with the CAR T doesn't necessarily mean that they will with a bispecific.
There isn't really a question, maybe just a statement, a sequencing therapy, which is really just the million-dollar question, isn't it? So I think we could probably round out in terms of how do you – I know that that is a large area of research, and I guess if you could have your wish of what questions you'd like answered as it relates to sequencing, because that is the question to be answered, what would that be? Since the buzz really wasn't a question, but I think something that could be very interesting.
Yeah, I'll start because we've thought about this a lot. And, you know, we're getting, if you think about myeloma as a disease, it drops CD20, so it's not a lymphoma. It really, when you really boil it down, it looks more like ALL than it does any other cancer type. And so what does that mean for therapy? Well, I think it means we need to probably start to adopt ALL type approaches. So start to have really intensified treatment plans with a goal of cure at some point down the road. And so what does that mean? It means an initial heavy induction therapy, some degree of maintenance, consolidation, intensification, and all the things we think about within ALL, and use these tools as a whole to try to get to the minimized disease burden with optimal quality of life for as long a period of time as possible. It's almost going back to the future. It's like the idea of the Arkansas approach, but is now with a lot more unique therapies and ways to get there. So sequencing to me is not necessarily which class should go where. It's more how do we put it all together for the total experience of a patient from the time of diagnosis. And that to me is the biggest research question that's out there, and what makes sense at various times and what can be used as biomarkers, pharmacodynamic markers to tell us earlier than perhaps IgG rises or gamma globulin rises, what might be therapeutically most beneficial. Cytogenetics will also continue to play a big role in this.
Well, thank you all for joining us so bright and early this morning.
This activity is certified by PVI, Peerview Institute for Medical Education. Remember to download the slides and practice aids. Thank you for listening. Download materials and complete the post-test for instant credit at peerview.com/CWA860. This activity is supported by independent medical education grants from Janssen Biotech Incorporated, administered by Janssen Scientific Affairs, LLC, Regeneron Pharmaceuticals Incorporated, and Sanofi.